Wow, my first day on the moon. I totally have to tweet that I'm here. Oh man, no bars on my phone. Must be a dead spot. Let's see, I've got my solar wind power microwave oven and my four meat and cheddar hot pockets, and I've got it going on. Pocket like it's hot, pocket like it's hot. Whoa, one of those moon robins snatched the crisping sleeve right out of my hand and dropped it in a crater. What am I supposed to do now, you stupid bird? Hey, some lunar mice just knocked my ramen-flavored packets into a fissure. This is not what I imagined at all. I'm kind of making a big mess up here, and there's no one to hang out with. Not even the moon rocks I'm taking back and selling illegally will make me feel better. Did I say that out loud? Kidding! Today we're revisiting our conversation about how to preserve the moon and about black market moon rocks. And now he's got binders full of lunar dust. Colin McEnroe.
We've got a lot of interesting ground to cover, a lot of lunar surface to cover here, and a little bit of time taken out of our show today by the pledge drive, too. So I'm going to be brisk. We're going to start. We are going to talk eventually about the fascinating story of the rocks that have been and other kind of geological stuff that's been removed from the moon and kind of what's happened to it all. It's a very different story, at least than what I thought. But we're going to begin with the whole idea of what's up there on the moon right now, including what's up there that we put there and what to do with it and how to treat it. All right, we're going to start our conversation here with Robert Perlman. He is the science editor for CollectSpace.com, an online publication and community for space history and artifact enthusiast. Robert Perlman, first of all, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And so tell us, let's start, because I know this is one of the areas that Beth O'Leary, whom you know, is interested in. Let's start with the Apollo 11 landing site, with Tranquility Base. What ultimately should be our attitude about that? I mean, in some ways, a lot of the stuff that happened on Tranquility Base happened in a hurry, and you had astronauts urinating in bags and leaving them there and leaving their moon boots and remembering at the last minute to put out the medallions and the patch to honor the fallen astronauts. I mean, it isn't a beautifully curated site. Does it need to be preserved, though, kind of exactly the way it is?
I think it does, and I think many historians and space enthusiasts think the same. The site was not left in pristine condition, but that's part of the history that it captures. It was our first steps anywhere off this planet onto another body, another celestial body, and they've said a lot of different think tanks and futurists have said that 1,000 years from now, the only thing that's going to be remembered of our century, of our contribution, is going to be those first steps into space. And so, without an atmosphere, without any wind to dam, erode their footprints and to move things around, the site is pretty much exactly as it was 40 plus years ago. And it will only be disturbed if we decide to go up there and start trouncing around on it.
And speaking of going up there and trouncing around, obviously there's some talk about having some kind of mission with astronauts aboard the Orion spacecraft. Is that the first group that's going to get up there, or one of these privately funded groups going to get up to the moon next?
Well, the first thing that might get to the moon, to get onto the moon, maybe some commercial robotic rovers.
Mm-hmm.
There's a competition called the Google Lunar X Prize that has challenged private groups to develop a small rover that can land on the surface of the moon, drive around, beam back HD video, and as part of the prize, they have a heritage prize of filming something that we've put on the moon. It doesn't need to be an Apollo landing site. It could be a robotic lander, one of the surveyors that we sent. It could be a piece of Soviet robotic machinery, but something that was put there by man. And so these questions about do you disturb the sites is relevant, because in the next few years you might have these little wheeled rovers roving around, and you don't necessarily want them roving over Neil Armstrong's footprints.
All right. We're talking to Robert Perlman. He's the science editor for CollectSpace.com, an online publication and community for space history and artifact enthusiasts. Also with us, I think we have her now to join this conversation, Beth O'Leary, an assistant college professor of anthropology at New Mexico State University, very interested in the whole issue of moon preservation and Apollo 11's landing site as a World Heritage Site. So Robert Perlman's been talking about this a little bit, but let's sort of back up. Beth O'Leary, Who makes the rules for the moon right now, and who should be making the rules for the moon?
Well, the moon is governed by treaty, by international treaty, and the 1967 Treaty on Outer Space governs the moon. And essentially, they didn't think about historic preservation when they made up that treaty, but it does say in Article 8 that they are supposed to, the nations and states that put artifacts and personnel on another celestial body retain title to that. And so, in effect, the United States still owns those artifacts on the moon. And I prefer to call them artifacts instead of space junk, because, as Mr. Perlman said, you know, we didn't leave it in pristine condition when the Apollo 11 artifacts were put there, but that is the first human presence on another celestial body, and that's what we as archaeologists deal with.
In some ways, could not the case be made, and I want to hear both of you on this, but we'll start with you, Beth O'Leary. Could not the case be made that, well, I mean, in terms of historical interest, in terms of human interest, most of us are not going to get up to the moon. You know, it's going to be generations before people are getting up to the moon with any kind of frequency. So in terms of like looking at something, whatever value accrues to looking at something like a cosmonaut medallion that's been sitting on the moon surface for X number of years, wouldn't it make sense to bring some of this stuff back so we could look at it?
Sure, and we do that as archaeologists. We collect material that we find out from prehistoric sites, and we analyze it and figure out, really, because archaeology is the study of the patterns of material culture with human behavior. So collection is fine, but it has to be regulated. You know, if you collect everything, then that locational integrity, that place that makes it so special, and I'm talking about the stuff on the moon, is gone. And so it loses some of its exceptional significance. So we need a framework to figure out what to collect, how to collect it, what's significant up there. Because right now there's over 80 archaeological sites on the moon, and estimates range from about 100 to 112 metric tons of cultural material that humans have put there, both ourselves, Soviets, and other spacefaring nations.
Now, most of that stuff wasn't sort of put there by hand the way, say, the medallions or the urine bags or whatever were put there by hand. Most of that stuff was kind of, I don't know how to say it, but it was sort of mechanically put there, right?
Yeah, it was put there by robots. There's a lot more robotics on the moon than there are manned missions, because there were only 12 humans that were on the moon. So, but each one of those particular artifacts or spacecraft or the Surveyor 3 is evidence of a stage of human technological culture. And it's pretty important. When I look at all of human history, which I do as an archaeologist, you know, this is an incredible time period. We are always been an exploring species. You know, we left Africa, we moved into the other parts of the world, and for the first time in 1969, we actually put a human on another celestial body. So I see it as a continuation of our need to explore, and it took a great deal of technology to get those two guys up there.
Robert Perlman, you've been listening to all this, and you were talking before about Google's Lunar X Prize, this $20 million competition to get a private organization to put a robotic rover up there. First of all, are they answerable to the same set of rules and norms that Beth O'Leary was talking about and treaties, and should they be?
Well, depending on where they're based, in terms of they're based in the United States or if they're based in another country, they're subjective to the laws of the country, and they have to obey by the treaties that that country has signed on to. But the organizers of the prize itself have made it clear that they want to respect the history that's present on the moon. They'd like to do that in a way that would enable their prize to go forward, but they'd like to... They actually sought NASA's input on what might be the right way to approach this topic. And NASA recently put out their first set of guidelines on what it thought was their property on the moon and what, or the United States property on the moon and how those areas should be protected. You know, getting back to your earlier question about bringing it back or leaving it in place.
Yeah.
You know, I sort of compare it in a modern-day example to the Titanic. in a sense that there was a value, a real value of having the ability to see the Titanic in place underwater or through submersibles, that not everyone could go, but a limited group of people could go. But there was also a service to history by bringing up pieces from the ocean floor to now tour in touring exhibits and in museums, because eventually those materials were eroded away. But that's not the same with the moon. In the moon, the items up there, a good number of the items up there, will be there for a very long time. And eventually we will start going there with not just rovers, but people. And commercial efforts will bring people there, tourists there as well. And if you can imagine being able to today find Columbus's footprints in the Indies, or finding exactly where in Plymouth Rock the Pilgrims came ashore, you'd want to preserve that. And we now have the opportunity to do that with the moon.
All right, we're going to talk a little bit more about this. We do have to take a quick break here, a very quick break. We'll be back.
Take a trip in my rocket ship. We'll have a lovely afternoon. Kiss the world goodbye, and away we'll fly. A destination moon. We'll travel fast as light to out of sight. The earth will be like a toy balloon.
All right, we're back. We're talking about moon preservation. Beth O'Leary is here with us from New Mexico State University. She's a professor of anthropology. Robert Perlman is the science editor for CollectSpace.com, a publication and community for space history and artifact enthusiasts. Beth O'Leary, I want to go back to this idea about treaties and some of the stuff that Robert was just talking about, too, about tourists and stuff like that. I mean, one thing we do know, and I'm going to kind of preempt a phone call I see up on the board from Fred from Middletown. I'm going to steal his idea. One thing we do know is that here on Earth, there are all kinds of people who don't want to obey treaties. And there are Somali pirates. There's all kinds of people out there who do what they want to do. Is that a fear for you, that pretty soon there are going to be people up there who just kind of don't care what the treaty says?
Well, a treaty is an agreement among people that trust each other, and people break treaties all the time. But the point is that in the 60s, when this was created, people didn't want to see the militarization of space. They wanted to see Earth as a peaceful place for scientific research. And those signatories, I think, have agreed with that. And just to comment on Mr. Perlman, you know, NASA did in July of last year come out with these recommendations for spacefaring entities, and part of it was in response to the Google XPRIZE going up there with the robotic. And so they made some decisions, NASA did, based on information. I was part of a team, Roger Lanius at the Smithsonian, of how to best preserve or not impact some of these sites by creating some boundaries. So NASA is stepping forward to provide some technical guidance on how to get close to the sites but not disturb them and not take away those characteristics of the artifacts and the features that would destroy them or damage them.
You know, I'd be interested in hearing both of you on this, but, you know, we're talking right now about the preservation of these artifacts that we put there and sites where we've landed and stuff like that. I mean, there's this whole other question of preservation. As I was saying towards the beginning of the show, this is an unusually undisturbed surface. It's undisturbed in the way Earth absolutely is not. And the fact that it has no significant atmosphere means erosion happens less or happens in a different way. And meanwhile, we know there's water up there. It's a matter of time before people are really going to be up there trying to mine the water, and because it can be obviously used for further space exploration, and because the gravity's less, you can travel up there without so much water and get some more water there. Should we be worried, Beth O'Leary, not just about preserving Neil Armstrong's moon boots and urine bag, but also preserving, like, the moon?
Well, I think the moon is the place, and the footprints themselves are important, and the rocks, those particular rocks, are even now providing information for scientists. You know, tranquilitite has been discovered as a very rare mineral that Neil Armstrong collected when he came back, and now we're finding about, you know, how old the moon is and all different things about moon geology. So I think there's, you know, good science to be done. And by the way, some of these artifacts that they left up on the moon are still working. The Lunar Laser Ranging Retroreflector is still sending data back as we beam our lasers from observatories onto the moon and collecting data. So it has scientific and heritage value. And Mr. Perlman is right. The moon is a very benign place in terms of disturbance. There's no wind and erosion. There's great temperature swings. But I work in archaeology here in the Southwest, and a lot of things just get blown away or changed or damaged by the natural processes. And the moon is a fairly pristine place.
The what about that, Robert Perlman? Should we have like some national parks and stuff like that up on the moon before BP gets up there and starts trying to pull water out of it?
Well, in part, the water-rich areas that we would be looking to use would be, A, not to bring it back to Earth, mm-hmm. not necessarily bringing it back to Earth, because you wouldn't. That would be economically challenging at the least. Not to mention logistically challenging, it would be to support colonies on the moon.
Mm-hmm.
And potentially to create fuel so that you could launch off the moon and go elsewhere,
right,
onto Mars and elsewhere. So at first, these efforts are going to be rather small, and they're going to be actually located far away from where the Apollo sites landed, most likely towards the poles, towards the South Pole in particular. And so I don't know if a national park type system is called for just yet. Also, there is a situation in that the treaties that we have now do prevent nations from declaring sovereignty over the moon. So while we can claim the United States can claim possession of the artifacts it left there, it doesn't own the land on which those artifacts sit. You would have to have you'd either have to back out of the treaty that we currently subscribe to, or you'd have to create new regulations for lunar-bound nations if they wanted to start claiming lunar property. And there are advocates for that as well. Some see allowing a lunar property claim system as a way of motivating nations and companies to start pushing us further out into space, and there's something to be said for that.
I want to know if we even know everything that's up there, and I called to mind a little moment in the movie The Right Stuff where Gus Grissom and Gordon Cooper are in a bar talking about Grissom's space flight the next day. Let's hear a little bit of that.
Miss, how'd you like one of these?
I can get one of those from a dime store.
Not one that's been in outer space, you came. I'm taking these up there with me tomorrow. You think you might like a little souvenir after I get written up in the history books?
Well, I might, if it's been in outer space.
See you after outer space, miss.
All right.
Hey, I'm not. Listen, you got to think ahead to the future. Folks got a taste for things that have actually been there. I'm even going to give you one of these dimes I'm taking up there with me tomorrow so as you can play with it in your pocket. Dream about outer space.
And there is the very star-crossed Gus Grissom talking about how he's going to bring up these little toy capsules in space and some dimes, too. So that raises the question, Beth O'Leary, do we actually know everything that got brought up there if you've got astronauts with their own little side projects like this?
No, we don't. That was a challenge for me when I worked with students to find out exactly what was on the Apollo 11 site. We thought it would be easy, and it wasn't. We've published a list of over 106 artifacts, and we consider the footprints to be features of the site. But we don't know everything that is up there. You know, people bring and take things for symbolic reasons, and to hold in your hand something that's been in outer space or on the moon is kind of impressive, I think. But again, we're looking at a legal gray area because it does talk about, you know, who owns the artifacts, but it doesn't talk about how we preserve them, how we evaluate them and find which ones are significant, how we collect them. And it has to be a system that works internationally because we have an international presence on the moon. And with commercial people going back, you know, to provide guidance to them is important at this stage.
Just very quickly, Robert Perlman, you know, we're going to talk in the next segment about the stuff that came back. In general, given what you know from traffic on your site, how much excitement and how much of a market is there for the kind of thing that Beth O'Leary is talking about, holding in your hand something that's been on the moon?
There's a considerable market, and it's growing. It's limited also by the number of items that actually did come back, which is not a whole lot, not in terms of items that can be personally owned. And so collectors do pursue artifacts that the astronauts were able to keep. The astronauts did bring, just like the dimes that Gus Grissom mentioned, and you have to keep in mind, Right Stuff was a fictionalized version of the history. Mm-hmm. Director Philip Kaufman really wanted to capture the sense of the era, not necessarily the specifics of Tom Wolfe's excellent book. But the astronauts did carry items in what was called a personal preference kit that they were allowed to keep, and then those items were given away, gifted in a lot of cases, but then later sold in later years to collectors, and they've sold for tens of thousands of dollars.
We're going to take a short break here and do a little bit of fundraising here, but we'd also be fascinated to hear from you a little bit more about this. Let me go quickly sort of just tell you, if you're just joining us, what we're talking about here. Beth O'Leary is with us. She's a college professor of anthropology at New Mexico State University. She's interested in making the Apollo 11 landing site a World Heritage Site and have all that stuff that's up there kind of undisturbed. Robert Perlman, science editor for collectspace.com. You may want to check that out a little bit later. It's publication and community for space history and artifact enthusiasts. In the final segment, you're also going to meet an attorney and retired undercover agent for NASA who likes to be called the Moon Rock Hunter. It turns out these rocks that came back, you'd think that they would be just constantly watched over and guarded like a mother hen with eggs in the nest, but not so much. It turns out the rocks have gone all kinds of odd places. So we'll be talking a little bit about that when we come back from this break.
I gotta say, what's really cool about being up here on the moon is you could just get away from all that crazy stuff going on down there on planet Earth. Oh man, how did I get a Kardashian Christmas card? I don't even know my address up here. Today's show was produced by Patrick Scahill, Betsy Kaplan, and me. The part of Bill Curry was played by Alan Bean. On tomorrow's show, we revisit our conversation all about boy bands. And now, back to Colin.
Alan Bean, of course, one of the astronauts who did walk on the moon, although I think nobody knows the names of any astronauts except basically the first two. But we want to talk a little bit about what happened after things started to come back from the moon, lunar samples, I mean. And so Robert Perlman is still with us. We'll talk a little bit more in just a second about his site. But also joining the show is Joe Guthines. Joe Guthines is sometimes called the Moon Rock Hunter. He's an attorney and retired undercover agent for NASA. And Joe Guthines, welcome to our show.
Thank you very much for having me.
So I was 14 years old at the time of the first lunar landing, and it was obviously for somebody, you know, who'd grown up in a world like the world that I was in, where we didn't go walking around on the moon. It was this incredible deal. I mean, it was just unbelievable. And if someone were to tell me at that time that the rocks that were coming back from this lunar exploration were going to be anything other than perfectly husbanded and curated and kept track of all the time, I wouldn't have believed them. But apparently, and maybe you can sort of just kind of sketch out the dimensions of this problem, there's a lot of rock that kind of goes missing or winds up unaccounted for.
Yeah, let me begin with the Apollo 11 mission. When the Apollo 11 crew came back, our people on the ground at NASA took possession of their boots, their equipment, and so forth. And you would think that they would, the items that were actually on the moon, that they would carefully, meticulously take any dust or moon off of them and keep them. Mm-hmm. What they did was they washed it away. And, of course, we've given, and I wasn't privy to what Robert Perlman said, but Robert Perlman is a superb individual. My students have dealt with him over the years, and he really has the only accountability system for the moon rocks that we gave away to the states and nations of the world through his where the Apollo 11 and where the Apollo 17 webpages they maintain. But of the 270 moon rocks that we gave away to the nations of the world, approximately 160 are now missing, destroyed, stolen outright. Of the 50 that Apollo 11 moon rocks that we gave to the states, 18 approximately are unaccounted for. And of the 50 Apollo 17 moon rocks that we gave away to the states, six are unaccounted for. And again, just to give you three of my favorite student stories about students, and if I'm over talking, you let me know. But last year, or 2010, I had a student by the name of Sandra Shelton hunt down the West Virginia Apollo 17 Goodwill moon rock. Now, remember, on the black market, this moon rock could sell for $5 million. She finds that West Virginia was, in fact, missing their moon rock, and a front-page story comes out predicated on her investigation. A 90-year-old woman contacts her and says, "My son has the moon rock." My student calls me out of a board meeting. I call up the kid, or the kid is 68 years old. Robert Connors, his name. I call up the man, and sure enough, he describes it to the T, 10 by 14-inch plaque with a lucite ball, flag of the state, two metal plates. And the story on that was Governor Arch Moore, when he left office, took the moon rock with him. Yeah. He gave it to his partner who died, and his partner leaves the moon rock along with his possessions to his brother, who maintains his $5 million moon rock in his garage until the story came out.
My mother threw out all my moon rocks. Hey, Robert Perlman, as Joe Gudhines is talking, first of all, one of you, I'm assuming maybe Robert, since Joe says you have like the best system, please tell us that Connecticut hasn't lost their moon rock. And second of all, and I know this isn't the only kind of moon rock there is, because there's a lot of scientific samples, and we can talk about those. But Robert Perlman, what's going on here? Why would attitudes change so much that moon rocks could be treated as casually as Joe Gudhines just described?
Well, it's not a clear answer. I mean, part of it is the test of time. Part of it is that moon rocks aren't diamonds. They're not shiny. They're not sparkly. They're little gray or black pieces of rock. And in the case of the Apollo samples that we gave away, they were further embedded in a small lucite ball and then attached to a wooden plaque that has a definite 70s feel to it. And so while Joe and I would say that those should be star attractions in any nation's museum, we've heard from curators in the past who said, you know, well, we have, in some cases it was, well, we have this large moon rock on loan from NASA that we can show to our visitors, so why do we need to put out this tiny little speck of a moon rock that is on a plaque that most people won't look at? In other cases, it's just been they haven't even recognized what's on the plaque. They see a plaque and they see the flag and they don't really recognize that the moon rock above it is what's the star attraction.
So please tell us, Connecticut, we didn't lose our moon rock, did we? Does either one of you know?
Yeah, well, Connecticut, you have both of them accounted for. The Apollo 17 sample is at the Museum of Connecticut History at the State Library in Hartford. And the actually both are. at the same location in Hartford.
That is a relief. I was very concerned that Governor Rowland might have traded it for a Mustang or something.
And it was one of Joe's students that found them. So credit to his students.
Well, you know, Joe Gutheinz, you know, I introduced you as a sometimes undercover agent. Are there occasionally, I mean, you know, we just heard this fairly benign story about just sort of people not paying too much attention and the moon rock winds up in the garage. Are there bad guys who wind up with moon rocks?
Oh, sure. Former dictator of Romania, Ceausescu.
Okay, he's a bad guy.
He's a bad guy. He was executed on Christmas Day in 1989. And when he died, his Apollo 17 moon rock fell into the confines of his estate, and they sold it. Here's a communist, the estate for a communist, and they're selling it to a capitalist, and now that moon rock's unaccounted for. Yeah, there have been a number of stories. Franco's grandson allegedly was trying to see how much the moon rock would go for in Switzerland. Gaddafi, he dies, and both of the moon rocks that were given to Libya are missing. And so one of the problems is that we gave a lot of these moon rocks that are invaluable, really, to some of the world's worst thugs and dictators, and now we're surprised that they're missing.
Well. Also, is there some kind of black market in this stuff? And maybe not all entirely the goodwill rocks that we're talking about, but we're going to talk a little bit in a minute or two also with Robert Perlman about the scientific samples. But are there, when I say bad guys, I also mean, are there sort of black market guys who are just running around selling moon rocks that they've got one way or another?
Let me go back to 1998 when I went undercover in Operation Lunar Eclipse. We had an undercover sting operation that I created out at Johnson Space Center, and the purpose of the sting operation was not to catch people selling real moon rocks. It was to catch con artists engaged in one of the world's most perfect crimes, the sale of fake moon rocks.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why it's a perfect crime is, here's the line that's universally used. I've got a real moon rock that I got from Neil Armstrong or Gene Cernan or somebody of that nature. And here's a letter to prove it with the NASA logo on it and so forth. I'll sell it to you for $20,000. Now, if you tell anybody, agents will knock on your door and they'll seize it. So the buyer understands that it's probably stolen property or claimed by NASA. And he takes the property, he puts it in the safe, and locks the safe and doesn't tell anybody about it until he dies and then his kids trip over it. So the bottom line is that's who we were looking for, con artists engaged in that type of scam. What happened in 98 was we put a quarter-page ad in USA Today reading Moon Rocks Wanted. And a guy approached me and he said, Tony, my undercover name was Tony Coriasso. He says, Tony, all those other guys are approaching you selling you bogus moon rocks, and I've got the real thing. And he leads me to this elaborate web page, and sure enough, there's a 10-by-14-inch plaque with a lucite ball. And I knew at once that we may, in fact, have an Apollo 17 moon rock, but we didn't know from where. There have been other stories like that have gone on, a possible sale of $5 to $10 million of one of the Apollo-era moon rocks in the Middle East. Again, the Franco thing. But there have also been thefts where after the moon rock was stolen, nobody hears about it. And one in particular is Malta. In Malta's Medina Museum, an individual walks in. There's no security, no people in the museum, just a ticker taker. He walks into the museum, opens up a glass case, pulls the moon rock off of the plaque, and walks out with it. And nobody has heard about that moon rock since. And it's presumed that he sold it on the black market or has in some way profited from it. Just give me, let me give you two other examples.
Well, just before we go there, because I want to sort of manage our time a little bit carefully, Joe Gutheinz, just back to you for Robert Perlman for a second. There are the Goodwill rocks that he's talking about, and in the case of those, it sounds like more are missing than are accounted for. But there's also a tremendous number, 26,000 or something like that, samples that NASA has. Give us sort of a sense, are those missing too? I mean, I'm talking about the scientifically studyable ones.
There are samples that a recent Office of Inspector General audit found were not accounted for. The problem was that NASA's tracking system for keeping in touch with scientists as they received these samples on loan, they were never given away outright, was not to par with what needed to be done. I mean, they would get in touch with the institution a year after the loan expired and said, well, are you still keeping it? Are you still using it? And what the inspectors found were the samples were, in some cases, had been in possession for decades and never been used because either the scientist was waiting for funding to come in for a particular grant or had just assumed that they had them indefinitely. There were some that had done the studies but had not returned the material because they figured once they were done with their studies, they could keep the material, and that was not true either. These pieces are put out on loan. The same is true for educational samples. NASA loans educational lucite or acrylic encased samples for students to be able to see in classrooms, and in some cases, in one particular case that sort of sparked this whole recent investigation, a planetarium had received it, and when NASA got in touch after the loan period had expired, they found out that the individual who was in charge of that sample had actually passed away, and no one knew where it was. And I don't think that's actually been resolved. NASA says they don't have it. Planetarium says they don't have it, and so it's somewhere out there.
Wow. Joe Gutheinz, we're kind of running out of time here, but it sounds like in some ways people have been kind of sloppy about taking care of moon stuff, and maybe in the public psyche there's this kind of rising indifference to them. But you must also be dealing with people who really rabidly want to hold this stuff in their hands, right? People who just get crazy for samples?
Oh, sure. You know, the space enthusiasm is... there's nothing to compete with it except for maybe Star Wars memorabilia. But the thing that just to follow on what Robert said, NASA's also lost moon rocks in the mail. Scientists have washed the moon rocks down the sink. We've had some real egregious stories involving moon rocks.
Oh, wow. Well, listen, this has been fascinating stuff. I wish we had another hour to talk about it, seriously. Joe Gutheinz is an attorney and retired undercover agent for NASA. The moon rock hunter, Robert Perlman from CollectSpace.com. We got to get out of here. Please be generous in supporting the station and the show.
Everyone's gone to the moon. Everyone's gone to the moon.
I'm Kyone Wolf on the moon. Hey, look, it's Buzz Aldrin's footprint. I gotta step on it so I can say I stood where Buzz Aldrin stood. That's one small step for public radio and one giant leap for... Oh, I probably shouldn't have done that.